The outdoor circle calls it blight. Others worry about public safety. Several lawmakers are saying enough is enough. They're pushing for an end to double poles in older neighborhoods across the state. Turns out Hawaiian Electric has a replacement pole program, but there's no requirement for when the old pole has to get pulled out, and it may take years. Senator Gil Riviere introduced a bill to force an end to the blight. It's signed by about a dozen lawmakers in support.
I introduced this bill because there is a proliferation of double poles, especially around my district, which goes to the north and Windward Shores. And what I mean by double poles is Hawaiian Electric will install a new telephone pole to take care of the electricity service, but they leave the original pole next to it sometimes for up to 5 years before the other utilities finally move their services. And it just becomes a visual blight. It's a safety hazard, and I don't think we should allow it to continue growing as it is.
So you did some research. What did you find out about all these poles? How many do we have out there?
We found out that as far back as 10 years or more ago, they started getting a backlog, which was building by about 150 a year. So presently there's 15,000 of these double and sometimes triple poles throughout the state.
And these are in older neighborhoods here on Oahu and everywhere else, I guess.
Yes, anywhere there's the old-fashioned traditional telephone pole, that's where they proliferate.
So I understand that the utilities have a special committee that meets occasionally to talk about these poles.
There is a joint pole committee which meets between and it's an association of the utilities services, and there are agreements that are made depending on who owns the pole and who maintains them, and who's responsible for taking care of them. But what happens is, as Hawaiian Electric updates their poles due to safety, many of the other utilities are not ready or able to keep up with that rate of change. And so the poles just languish, sometimes without any utility service on them. And then for years, they just stay there as two poles. Sometimes they're broken, and they'll cut off the top, or they'll cut off even the bottom and strap the entire pole, the old pole, to the new pole.
So it's really a blight on the neighborhood.
Yes, they're very ugly. And once you're aware of this, you will see them everywhere. And people throughout my district have been noticing them, and they've been complaining more and more. And for the last year, I've been trying to work real hard with the Public Utilities Commission to encourage them to begin making the change. And I think we start making the change by stopping this practice of additional double poles.
I know the bill got some support from the Outdoor Circle. They were concerned about the rate at which these poles were being switched out.
Yes, yes, oh yeah. In fact, I called a friend of mine who is a member of the North Shore Outdoor Circle, and I said, hey, what do you think about the utility poles? And she volunteered, oh, they're so dangerous, and they're old, and they're ugly. And, oh, the double poles. Let me tell you about the double poles. So she was well ahead of me. I didn't even have to bring up the double poles. And she was aware that that's an issue that Outdoor Circle has been aware of and trying to work on.
And you said that you also saw some that were like even triple poles in some neighborhoods.
Yes. They'll put one up, and then they'll put a second one, and then within a year or two, there might be three, and they still never vacate the original ones. And I have photos of that I can share with anybody.
So do you have any near where you live?
Yes, on my street, just in the past few months, they've put, I think, six of these double poles up, and they took one of the old poles down. So they're everywhere. They're everywhere where I live.
There's also some concern about notification, that really the folks that live in the neighborhood don't know what the schedule is, or when they plan to come in and replace poles. That there's not any real protocol on behalf of the utilities to notify the residents.
Yes, that's the other tragedy of this situation. Is most of our houses grant an easement for utilities near the road, so that means the utility companies have the right to install their services and put poles and whatnot, but it falls through the cracks when they don't notify the neighbors that there will be a brand new pole, stuck right next to the existing pole right in front of their house, and without any information or insight to the residents. It's I think they definitely have got to improve that notification process And the design considerations are important, too.
I know of one case in Kahalu where the homeowner and his wife were told that the power would be out while they were replacing the pole, and so they left their home. When they came home, they were surprised to see a pole that was twice the size blocking their view. So
yes.
There's kind of little recourse for the residents in that case.
There is very little recourse because of the in that case, it's the competing demands. You need a reliable, safe power delivery service. But without any discussion or consideration or concern for aesthetics, perhaps in that situation, perhaps they could move the pole 5 feet or 10 feet one way or the other, and maybe had the same safety and security, but maybe had less impact on the residents.
So your bill would have simply addressed the situation going forward. Did it address the poles already in the ground?
No, my intention was to stop the proliferation of the double poles, and then by not having additional poles, the next step would be to start addressing the backlog and getting rid of all of the double poles.
And I saw that there was testimony submitted by the utilities that were objecting to your bill.
Yeah, the utilities claimed that it would have tied their hands. The bill that I introduced would have required any new pole to have a plan to remove the original pole within 90 days. Hawaiian Electric testified very strongly against, saying that would prevent them from being safe and putting in any new poles in an emergency situation, which I don't agree with that, because they would still have 3 months to come back and take care of the other pole. They are working, apparently. What I understand is there's some discussion in the Joint Pole Committee and amongst utilities to aggressively solve this problem now. And I don't know if that's because there's a threat of a new law, or if they are finally getting to agreement on how to go forward. But either way, I think it's important that people be aware of this and to expect more from our utilities.
Well, I recall inquiring about this committee and, you know, asked to see minutes or reports, and they said there were none. So it was kind of a mystery to me as to how do we keep the utilities accountable for things like this if we don't even know what they're discussing.
That is probably why the chair of Consumer Protection and Health is directing this through the Public Utilities Commission to report back to the legislature on the fixes that are pending. So that might be a good amendment to this measure.
So the bill is advancing, and we'll see how far it goes this session.
At this point, yeah, it looks like it'll clear the Senate, and then it'll encourage more conversation on the House side. So one way or the other, I think we're bringing the awareness and hopefully bringing the change that will change the way these double poles are handled and looked at, and hopefully go back to taking care of our vistas and still keeping our community safe.
Right. It's one thing for the new neighborhoods, because most of the utilities are underground. But in the older neighborhoods, they're almost treated like second-class citizens.
It would be great if we had a cohesive plan to underground all of our utilities, and not just in the next year or two, but if we just determined that going forward we had a plan to put all of our utilities underground so they'd be safe from hurricanes and severe storms and things, I think we could all agree that would be ideal.
I'm told that in some venues there are cities that have mapped out a plan. You know, it may be several years, but there is a plan, a blueprint going forward.
Yeah, we need to build that, I think, that demand from the community. The utilities will say it's too expensive, can't be done. But I think it is of sufficient import when we look at places like Puerto Rico that are still without electricity 5 months after a hurricane hit them. I think we should do the investment and do the planning and have a logical, affordable, deliberative plan to move them all underground at some future date. And without, without demanding tomorrow, let's start moving in that direction. And I think, I don't know who would object to that as a plan.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator, for your time.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
That was Senator Gil Riviere. Senate Bill 3064 cleared its first hearing before the Consumer Protection Committee just yesterday with those amendments to get the Public Utilities Commission involved. I'm Catherine Cruz, and this is The Conversation. This is The Conversation, coming up, looking back on decades of a pioneering legal career. But first, your quiz.
Today we're looking back at Hawaii's roster of champion athletes who have held pro boxing world titles ever since the 1950s. Today's mystery boxer was born in 1940 in the territory of Hawaii and graduated from Farrington High School. He turned pro in his early 20s and gained global recognition when he won the world junior welterweight title with a second round knockout of Italy's Sandro Lopopolo in 1967. He defended his title a year later, but lost to Argentina's Nicolino Loche. His short-lived boxing career was based in Japan, and in 1970, the super lightweight champion retired at the age of 30 with a record of 34 wins, 3 losses, and 1 draw. For today's quiz, can you tell who we've been describing? Extra points, you can tell us how many of his 34 wins were knockouts. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
This is Ray Cruz, host of Latin Beat. We're thrilled to announce that American Roots will be returning to our air on March 3rd. This two-hour celebration of American music, blues and jazz, gospel and soul, old-time country and rockabilly, Cajun and Zydeco, Tejano and Latin, roots rock and pop, avant-garde and classical has always delighted our listeners. Tune in Saturday nights at 6 starting March 3rd and become a fan of American Roots.
The State House is scheduled to vote Tuesday on House Bill 2739. It's a measure to allow medically assisted aid in dying for terminally ill patients. The bill advanced in the wake of 5 hours of emotional testimony. We heard from both sides of the issue yesterday on this program and then got this call to our talkback line.
My name is Chris. I'm calling from Kauai. I'm a 56-year-old, longtime Hawaii resident, blessed to live in the islands for 30 years. I have an incurable cancer, and upon my diagnosis, my physician counseled me to set up legal residence in Washington State. The reason is because once the cancer spreads to my bones, he described my death as it's going to be very painful, and the time leading up to my death would also be very painful. If this bill is passed, it will relieve a huge stress off of my mind and my shoulders. And I would be able to stay here in Hawaii amongst my family and my friends as I passed away. I'd have the choice to end the pain and stop my suffering and the suffering of my family and my friends, because they obviously would be affected by this. I'm ex-Navy Special Forces, and I faced death many times, but I've never faced a lingering and painful demise. And that fills me with kind of an insidious fear. It's hard to shake. I think about it many times a day.
Our caller Chris went on to say that his beloved 14-year-old hunting dog recently had to be euthanized after a spinal injury. He questioned why we allow and even encourage such action for our pets, but deny that option to people. If you want to comment on something you heard on this program, you can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
The late University of Hawaii law professor John Van Dyke worked on historic and precedent-setting cases throughout his career in the areas of international law, human rights, environmental, and constitutional law, most of them cases with a focus on issues specific to the Asia-Pacific region and to Hawaii. His archive is being made available to the public at the law school this Monday, and we spoke with Sherry Broder, his widow and law partner, about the importance of his work in Hawaii and in this particular part of the world.
That is one of the things that makes this particular archive so important, because of his work both in the Pacific and in Northeast Asia, especially relating to international ocean law issues. When you look at, you know, some of the cases that he worked on in the Pacific, you'll see that it's very important and unique. For instance, he represented the people of Eniwetok and Bikini in their efforts to get compensation from the United States of America for atmospheric nuclear testing.
Mm-hmm.
And that case was heard in the Court of Claims. He represented the government of Vanuatu at the London Dumping Convention. And at that time, the Pacific nations were working together to try to stop the dumping of nuclear waste at sea. I mean, now we think, wow, would anybody do something crazy like that, dump nuclear waste at sea? But in fact, it was something that, you know, was going on all the time. And so they worked together with the Vanuatu, the Pacific nations, and they formed a coalition with the Swedish and other Scandinavian nations, and were able to get an amendment passed at the London Dumping Convention to stop the dumping of nuclear waste at sea. So I think that's another good example of kind of some of his unique work that he did. He also worked for the legislature in the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas on land issues, because they're, you know, still associated with the United States. And he was very involved in what they call, does the flag follow the Constitution? So in other words, the U.S. territories that we still have, Guam, CNMI, well, CNMI is not really a territory, but it's still the question applies to them. Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, do all the protections of the U.S. Constitution apply to them? And one reason he became very interested in that was because here in Hawaii, before we became a state and we were a territory, we were governed by what are called the insular cases. And so now these cases still apply to these territories, and, you know, issue is whether or not they're entitled to the full protection of the U.S. Constitution when they are under our flag. Not that many people are interested in the issue if they don't live in those places.
Well, there you have it, and that's where advocacy comes in, right?
Yeah.
And that seems to be a common thread in your work.
Well, yes. My husband and I worked together on many different cases. We represented the people of the Philippines who were tortured and murdered during martial law.
Mm-hmm.
We became involved in that case because Ferdinand Marcos came here after his overthrow,
departure.
I guess. Departure. imminent departure. So,
yeah.
Of course, he always said that he was hoodwinked into leaving, but I always thought it was very unfair that he should commit all those human rights abuses and then have President Reagan whisk him off in a U.S. Air Force jet and land him here in our beautiful state. And he gets to, in the beginning, he was living on the ocean in Niue. And
with Pampers boxes full of cash,
yes,
you may recall.
I do recall. So
how do you go about making a case like that, you know, of that kind of vast scope with that number of you know, plaintiffs?
Well, my husband, you know, taught international law and had been interested in, both of us were very interested in human rights issues, and we decided when he came here that we were going to sue him for violations of human rights. So Belinda Aquino, who was teaching in the Department of Philippine Studies at the time, we made contact with her, and she had already been contacted by a family, by Agapita Trajano, whose son had been picked up while he was asking questions of Aimee Marcos. And the next time anyone saw him, he had been tortured and was dead. So we represented her. That's how we got started. And then we joined forces with Robert Swift. He's in a big law firm on the East Coast. And we filed the class action lawsuit here in Hawaii. So in that case, we got to work with Melvin Belli. I don't know if you know who he is.
But oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, now people don't. But in those days, he was the king of torts. And he represented 26 victims who were immigrants and lived in San Francisco. And the ACLU of California represented the founder of the Communist Party of the Philippines, who had sought asylum in the Netherlands. So it was quite an interesting team, and we had a trifurcated trial in federal court. That means it was divided into three parts. First, we tried liability, then that went up on appeal, then we tried punitive damages, then that went up on appeal, then we tried compensatory damages, and that went up on appeal. But when we did the trial, the jury just loved Melvin Belli. I mean, oh, of course they loved us too. They loved us too. But they, you know, every time Melvin Belli would get up to ask a question or whatever, everybody would sit up straight, even though I personally thought we did a better job than he did. But he was quite a celebrity back in those days.
There is an element of theater to judicial processes.
Yes, and Melvin Belli was great at the theater of it, yeah.
What are the other qualities it takes to pursue a case like that, beside persistence and knowledge of the law?
Well, you know, you have to have as your number one principle, if you think you're doing the right thing, never give up.
Mm-hmm.
And so actually I've worked in that case 35 years, so unfortunately I'm following my own principle. We're still trying to collect in that case. We've collected about $26 million, which we've distributed in the Philippines to the clients. We're very fortunate in the United States that with the kind of judicial system that we do have. And not only did we argue in the case that international law views human rights violations as what we call jus cogens, which is a law that's above and beyond, and all nations agree. Mm-hmm. There's no question that a government's not supposed to abuse its citizens.
Torture is wrong.
Torture is wrong. So there's the Declaration on Torture, and you know almost all nations have signed it. There's a few who haven't, like North Korea. But in addition to that, once we filed the case, which it really was a seminal case, there had been really one big case before that called Phil-Ortega, but ours was the first human rights class action. The U.S. Congress passed a law, the Torture Victim Protection Act, and so we were able to use that in the case as well. So other places don't have those kinds of, you know, opportunities. I'm not saying not every place does, but it's more difficult, I think, in other jurisdictions, or it can be.
But that's a pretty good example of using the judicial process to make a difference, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes,
Attorney Sherry Broder is the widow and law partner of the late UH law professor John Van Dyke, whose papers will be available in a public archive on Monday at the law school. You can learn more about them on the Conversations Facebook page.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Civil Beat. Natanya Friedham has a story about how Hawaii taxpayers could end up paying for airfare to send homeless back to the mainland. It's a program the hotel industry is funding now. Morning, Natanya.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
So it's a bill, isn't it, to try and get state taxpayers to fund this program now?
In some ways, yes. The bill would allocate a certain amount of the transient accommodation tax to the Hawaii Tourism Authority. And it just says generally they have to use this money to address homelessness in resort or tourist areas. And one way that could be used is by further funding programs that are currently privately funded that help people who are homeless return to the mainland if they have homes over there.
Right. And I know that the program that we've got in place now, they've actually sent a couple of hundred homeless people back to the mainland where they came from.
Yeah, it's a substantial number. 491 people have been relocated from Hawaii. Some have just gone to neighbor islands, but others have gone, most have gone to the mainland or some to other countries.
Well, now, does this bill have anything to do with the fact that some lawmakers want to actually cut some of the funding to HTA so they can divert it somewhere else? Is there somehow, you know, pulling out from one pocket and putting it in the other?
I'm not aware if that is sort of the intention behind the bill, but I do know that people in the tourism industry, you know, the folks who currently fund these programs for relocation, the Hawaii Lodging and Tourism Association, are very actively, you know, arguing in favor of this relocation program. And this would, in one way, allow them to further fund it with tax money.
Anybody in opposition?
There are people who are sort of skeptic of whether or not this relocation program is effective at ending homelessness. And there are relocation programs for homeless people around the country. The Guardian did a very extensive report on 16 cities and counties and found that, well, in some ways, there are success stories. People will return to their homes and in safer places than they were homeless, you know, in their original place. Oftentimes, people were sent without a plan, ended up homeless in their new location, or they were coerced into taking either a plane or bus ticket.
Okay, well, we'll have to see what happens then. But thank you, Natonya.
Thanks for having me.
That was Natonya Friedham with today's Reality Check from Civil Beat. Harris Methodist Church began exploring the idea of being a sanctuary church more than a year ago. Its congregation voted on it last spring, but it was only until this past fall that it openly talked about its new ministry. It includes lending support to immigration cases like the one of Maui resident Tanya Venegas, who was facing deportation. The church sought advice from immigration attorneys and the American Civil Liberties Union before deciding to take this first step. We sat down with church officials, including sanctuary ministry leader Darlene Rodriguez. But we start out with Pastor Rona Magayam about what this means.
While we declared ourselves as a sanctuary covenant church, it still is a journey. It's a process. As we try to grapple with these different issues that come to us, what are its implications in terms of, yes, legality, safety, at the same time, what is it that our faith calls us to be? And that's a very basic question for us. In fact, yes, we started this a process of becoming a sanctuary covenant church when the new administration has all this executive orders that threatens the safeguard of many people. But I think we responded because we believe as a church that it is our faith thing to be. These are our faith calls. That's very basic. So we did not have we did not struggle whether we do it or not, but we do it because this is our faith calls us to be. So that's very, very basic. It's the ground of who we are as a church. That's why we did that.
Right. So I mean, no one wants anyone to say, quote unquote, break the law. And when folks are out of status, they are in some sense breaking the law. So, but we work with attorneys, and this is the case with people, churches around the country who have been doing this. They work with people who will have some kind of legal remedy. So there are workarounds, but oftentimes what happens in these cases is that people get picked up and then they don't have any help to realize that they can have some legal help. So it buys them some time. If someone comes into sanctuary and if nothing gets done for them, they can't live anywhere, especially in a church, forever, right? So that's not humane or legal for anyone involved. But this, it buys some time for people to perhaps find a remedy that they didn't have the time to think through or even get any legal help or have some kind of even public pressure to say, let's look at this differently. How are we going to deal with a family that gets split apart, where the mother gets deported and the children are American citizens? Is this a humane act? Let's think some of this through. Maybe the remedy might come through a legal working with a lawyer. Maybe it might come through, hopefully, on a larger policy level, where things like DACA actually, the reprieve just came through in terms of the Supreme Court denying the appeal. So there are things that can be done, and this is just one of them. But time is, I think, one of the best things that we can offer people who might be split apart, especially family.
There may be members of your congregation saying, okay, if we do this, could they arrest me?
Well, the thing is, this is not harboring. We will not be harboring someone. How this has worked in the past is there is an announcement. Usually, this is a person going into sanctuary. So they check in with the authorities and let them know where they are. So this is not an illegal act. But it does, like I said, provide some protection and offer some time for a legal remedy to be thought through and perhaps found.
We had that one woman from Maui. You were out there supporting her when she went down to the immigration office.
Yes.
And she has since left, I guess. But her family's split up, though.
Yes. What I understand from the information that we've got is the mother was deported, sadly, and then the children went to their father. I think in California, I'm not sure, but I mean, the reality is they were separated. So we have two children who lost their mother, where just because of this inhumane law that was imposed, whereas this mother has been faithfully working here, living without any criminal record or whatnot. So that is very sad.
Yeah, and she had been checking with authorities.
Yes, she has been. She has been checking with authorities, yeah.
Right. Okay. Anything else you can share? I mean, so it just sounds like you just saw an injustice and said this is our church and this is what we believe in and we're here if anyone needs us.
I think that this time calls for people to have courage in the face of great adversity. Pastor Chol talked about how do we come upon other people's suffering and what do we do about it, especially as Christians, as people of faith. So I think that I would hope other congregations and people of faith would also want to help a very vulnerable population and to follow their moral teachings and their spiritual beliefs and values in helping others who are oppressed and who might be suffering. And so I hope that, I know that this is where Harris has found a lot of its actions and what we do.
I would just like to say that we are inviting everyone who is willing to join us in this process. Just call our church office, 536-9602, if you want to join us in this process of helping people and building a more loving community, because that is what we should be doing. Regardless of your faith community, regardless of your religion, regardless of your race, your sexual orientation, our invitation is for you to join us in this movement towards building a more loving community, and hopefully we can be more loving than where we are at now.
That was Pastor Rona Magayayam and Sanctuary Ministry Leader Darlene Rodriguez. Harris Methodist Church says its declaration includes helping other churches in their quest to become sanctuary churches. The ACLU has advised churches not to ask about immigration status to avoid running afoul of the law. INS agents can arrest illegal immigrants regardless of where they are if they have a warrant. Earlier in
the show, we told you about the 1967 World Junior Welterweight Champion with Hawaii roots. Born July 6, 1940 in Honolulu, our mystery athlete graduated from Farrington High School. He was an ex-Marine who turned boxing pro in 1964. His fighting career was based mostly in Japan. He would compete for the next 6 years before injury sidelined him and he retired from the sport. Fans may remember seeing this super lightweight powerhouse defeat men such as Sandro Lopopolo, Luis Molina, Fujio Mikami, and Rocky Alarde. Nicknamed the Hammer Punch, Paul Fuji stepped out of the ring for the final time in 1970 after compiling a record of 34 wins, 3 losses, and 1 draw. 29 of those wins were knockout victories. Today, he works as a trainer at a boxing gym in Mito, Ibaraki in northern Japan.
And Catherine, we had a winner, Gerald Takesono of Kaneohe, had the answer, and that's our quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
On March 10th, well-known local jazz pianist Ethan Capone brings his technique and artistry to the Atherton Studio. Ethan has worked in many jazz ensembles and performed alongside Chris Botti and many others. At HPR, you'll be able to hear him showcase his own music, pure jazz piano. Visit hprtickets.org. Preferred pricing for station members. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
It's 11:44. We're going to take a pause from regular programming for the monthly civil defense siren test. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is the live audio broadcast segment of the Hawaii State Emergency Alert System. This test message is being broadcast simultaneously over all radio and television stations in coordination with the monthly test of the outdoor siren warning system. During this test, all warning sirens sound a steady 1 minute attention alert signal. If you hear this tone in circumstances other than a test, tune in to any local radio or television station for emergency information and instructions. Or if in a coastal inundation area, evacuate to higher grounds. Broadcasters in Hawaii voluntarily make their facilities available in times of emergency. We are testing the equipment connecting the stations to the emergency alert system. During an emergency, please pay close attention to official radio and television broadcasts for instructions from emergency management authorities. Do not tie up vital communications by making non-emergency telephone or cellular calls. If you need emergency assistance, dial 911. Emergency preparedness information is found near the front of your telephone directory. As a reminder, the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency recommends residents prepare an emergency kit with a minimum of 14 days of food, water, and other supplies. This concludes the test of the live audio broadcast segment of the Hawaii State Emergency Alert System. We return you now to regular station programming.
KHPR Honolulu, KKUA Wailuku, KANO Hilo, KHPH Kailua Kona, and KIPL Lihue.
You're back with the conversation, and the Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan lives in most people's minds as a kind of fantasy land, an idealized place where personal wealth is measured by one's happiness, the so-called Gross National Happiness Index. Photographer John Wertheim, in prolonged visits between 1991 and 2006, set out to balance fantasy with images of daily life, images that are currently on display at the East-West Center Gallery. We spoke with him about the qualities that make Bhutan unique.
There's no other country in the world like Bhutan. And one of the sayings that I heard from a, I can't remember, I think the guy was Swedish. No, he was a Swiss, working, a Swiss engineer, mentioned to me once that, and I quoted him in the book, this is a great quote, he said, the Bhutanese could become just like any other country, but no other country could ever become Bhutan. So they're subject to temptation. You know, they could blow it. They could lose it. But what they've got now is irreplaceable. because this is a country that is surrounded, well, India on one side, China on the other, you know, the conquered Tibet, mm-hmm. Sikkim, which the Indians swallowed in 1975, mm-hmm. Not too far away, you know, I think it's, what, 60 miles away, Bangladesh. So if your listeners have some sense of this geographical location, these are countries, you know, in Nepal, a stone's throw away, these are countries that are teeming with overpopulation, deforestation, pollution. Bhutan has got more than 70% of its country in forest cover. The deforestation surrounding it is catastrophic. Bhutan has no logging industry. You can't export logs from Bhutan. It's illegal. You can export forest products, in other words, furniture, mm-hmm. carving, but no lumber. Yeah, so it's quite a unique country. But I don't want the listener to get the idea that Bhutan, you know, it's known as the country of gross national happiness.
Exactly.
Okay. And I think it would do a great disservice to Bhutan for people to get the idea that it's a country just filled with happy monks meditating in caves.
Mm-hmm.
Bhutan is filled with people, human beings. And they have the same problems, the same desires, the same bad habits. Mm-hmm. It's not a country without crime. But I would put it this way: it doesn't have the sort of critical mass of the types of behaviors that can just spiral out of control to ruin a country, even though it does have crime. You know, I mean, just the exact same problems that every other country has. It just doesn't have that much of it. It's
right.
Like living in a park, a wild park full of wild animals, endangered species. I think that just gives people a breathing space.
Well, but they're not competing for it
yeah.
nearly as yeah. much as the surrounding countries.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the surrounding countries. If anybody's been to India or been to Bangladesh, or I mean, just get the vision of Kolkata now or Bombay. There's no homelessness in Bhutan. There's no begging. I've never seen a beggar. I've never seen a homeless person. That's unheard of in the countries around them, where people beg for a living.
Mm-hmm.
You know, homelessness, I mean, just even in Hawaii, a rich country like we have. So, yeah, it's a special place.
Well, what do you think's the key to all that? I mean, the fact that the population exists in just the right proportion to what's available?
Well, I think a lot of it's cultural. Traditionally, many, maybe I could even say most Bhutanese communities, and you have to understand that Bhutan is a lot of very steep, remote valleys and areas with slightly different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the languages spoken are derivatives of Tibetan with some Nepali dialects. It's about 75% Buddhist, 25% Hindu. But there are a lot of very unique cultures, very unique. You go to another valley, you cross over a pass, and you know, the dialect is hard to understand. But most of the country is matriarchal. A common tradition throughout Bhutan is for one woman to have up to four husbands. They're usually brothers. And they usually have different roles and responsibilities, even though all the children are shared among the brothers as all being their children. You know, maybe one is the guy who takes care of the farm and does the plowing, and the other is the guy who trades, also another very popular pastime, or I should say profession in Bhutan, is smuggling across the Tibetan border. So maybe one's the guy who goes on trading missions, and the other takes care of the yaks. And the wife, who is the matriarch, who really manages the farm and the house, kind of rotates them through. This is a great way to, a woman can only have so many children, especially if the husbands are away most of the time. So Bhutan has got a very low population because of this culture. Then you add to the fact that there's a lot of monks. There are a lot of nuns, so there's a lot of celibacy. Though not all of the Buddhist sects are celibate, most of them, except from the Nyingmapa. And then you have the Bompo, the pre-Buddhist religion of Bhutan. But most of the religious are celibates. So you don't have that. That's changing, though. Okay, that is changing. You know, they now, I think it was 1999. I was there before internet and TV, and then it arrived, and things changed. Changed significantly. I'll never forget a bumper sticker I saw in Thimphu, the capital, maybe 6-8 months a year after TV came, and it was TV ruined my life. Became a very popular bumper sticker.
It's a sort of a place to study its effects, you know, a petri dish to study the effects of modern civilization.
Yeah, yeah, and they're suffering from everything else that we are now. It's just like I said, it's not in as much of a critical mass. There is a lot of youth unemployment. I believe even though unemployment in general in Bhutan is quite low, among youth, it's quite high. So I think it's 13%. It's a serious problem because a lot of people, they come in from the villages, from the farms. They get an education, and they want a job in town. You know,
John, it's refreshing to hear it described as something other than the cliched real life Shangri-La.
Yeah,
with
that
the gross national happiness index, which is usually what comes down to us about Bhutan, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I just think that's not fair. And the show that we put together at the East West Center, I hope it conveys that message. You know, we've got everything from yak farmers or yak herders that up in the mountains at 18,000 feet to photographs and stories, nightclubs, discos, the whole gamut, and it's all there.
Photographer John Wertheim's exhibit, Bhutan, Gross National Happiness, will run until May 27th at the East-West Center Gallery on the University of Hawaii campus. Three monks from Bhutan will be creating a sand mandala at the gallery through tomorrow, with viewing hours from 10 in the morning to noon and from 4 to 6 p.m. each day. Admission is free. You can learn more on our Facebook page.
Aloha mai kakou. This is Ku'uipo Kumukahi, Manager of Hawaiian Culture and Community Relations at the Hyatt Regency Waikiki. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation at hawaiipublicradio.org.
There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host, our colleague Derek Malama, joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning, Chris.
Tomorrow, those who love Baroque music can hear some at the Lutheran Church of Honolulu.
That's right. Chamber Music Hawaii presents Voices of the Baroque, featuring the Honolulu Brass Quintet, the Faculty String Quartet, and the Chamber Singers. This program features well-known as well as rare works of the Italian and Spanish Baroque. And this is happening at 7:30 p.m. Tomorrow in the Lutheran Church of Honolulu.
And it's an interesting theater event on Maui, Derek. This is the final weekend for a play based on the true story of women who worked in a watch factory.
That's right. These Shining Lives is based on the true story of four young women in the 1920s who take jobs painting radium on watch faces, and radium is radioactive. The play focuses on the strength of these women who refuse to allow the company that stole their health to kill their spirits. And this is happening in the Creative Arts Center at Seabury Hall Friday and Saturday at 7 and Sunday at 3.
And the Doris Duke Theater has a festival of films directed by women.
The Women of Wonders Film Fest celebrates the lives and accomplishments of women around the world and also here in Hawaii. And the festival begins tonight, ends tomorrow. For a complete schedule of films, visit HawaiiWomenInFilmmaking.org.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, a look at what the numbers tell us about tourism in Hawaii.
Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and record your point of view. The number to do that is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Do join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.